This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Moore. Over the course of my career as a death investigator, I was part of several national committees. I had to travel all over the country, various meetings and that sort of thing. And one of my fondest memories was going to Michigan and teaching a group of investigators there the national standards for medical legal death investigation. And the spot chosen for that instruction was a place that became one of my favorite towns, certainly up north, and that's Grand Rapids, Michigan. I got to tell you, if you've never been there, it is a lovely, lovely place. I didn't expect it. And during that period of time, I appreciated, first off, how kind the people were, and also how very cold it was at night, because I was up there in November. Wound up going salmon fishing while I was there and almost drowned. But that aside, I loved that location and I loved that place. But today I've got a case I want to present to you all that is, at least in my way of thinking, is one of the most horrible ways that a person could die. It takes place just south of Grand Rapids in the town of Kentwood, Michigan. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Over the course of our marriage, Dave, Kim and I have rented multiple storage units over this period of time. They are a necessary evil, I think. Our house got destroyed by a tornado, and we salvaged everything that we could and put it into storage. And we've had to use them before as well, because we just can't seem to get rid of junk many times. And they certainly serve a purpose. But it's like when you go to one after you've rented it, every time you open the door to one of these places, you don't know what you're going to find inside, particularly as it applies to your property being degraded in there. Maybe there was a leak, which we've had happen before. Or maybe you smell something bad in there, like a dead animal, which we have found rats before. There's something about them that puts me off. And I think a lot of it has to do with the labor that's involved. But I got to tell you, Dave, when you go to a storage unit, one of the things you don't expect to find is a dead person. And that's essentially what our case revolves around today.
This story of the charred remains, that's the headline. Charred remains of woman found in padlock storage unit gutted by fire. My first thought, Joe, was how did you get in there to get padlocked in, for starters? Second, why didn't you call for anybody, you know? And yes, then down the list. And it's only after reading this and finding out that this, I don't know if it was a, you know, you mentioned Nancy says intent can be formed in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
I don't know what the intent was here. Was the intent to lock this person in there and cause her death?
I don't know. And they're not really spilling the beans at this point. This case is fresh. I mean, it is a new case, and it caught my eye because of the proximity to Grand Rapids and the bizarre nature of it.
Right.
And that's why I wanted, because I think that there's a lot that we can kind of discuss relative to the forensics here. But, you know, when we go out to assess an environment, first off, fire environments or the remnant thereof, you never know what you're going to find. I can't tell you how many times I've had friends. This has only happened to me once, but I've had colleagues that have actually discovered other bodies that they did not expect. One of the reasons is that when you walk into a fire scene, a lot of the items that are in there all look the same, because, you know, you're talking about fire, which is this kind of living, breathing entity that's seeking to continue. It's what fire is defined as, an uninhibited chemical reaction. That means that there's nothing that's going to, if anything disrupts it, there's like four components that you're looking for with fire in order to make it sustainable. If any of those four points along the continuum get disrupted in any way, then the fire is not going to, you know, it's not just going to simply burn itself out. You have to have a starter, which is a heat source. You have to have fuel, and then you have to have a free supply of oxygen. Okay. So that's more like 3 points along continuum, but you have to have all of those elements to come into place to sustain fire. And that's right. One of the things we look at. And the fuel for something like this is not necessarily, I know that many people think, well, gasoline or some type of petroleum agent is fuel. No, it's not. It's a starter or it's an accelerant, because, you know, when you burn up gasoline, when you use that as an accelerant, it burns up rather quickly, particularly in the gaseous form. But what you're looking at as far as sustainable fuel, I mean, think about the stuff that you've stored in your storage units over the years. You think about, I don't know if you're like anything like we were when we were really young. You didn't have handmade carved mahogany furniture. You had stuff made out of press board, really bad fabrics on the coverings. Then you had pictures and all kinds of other stuff, old clothes, things like that. And then to boot, you got cardboard boxes. Hey, you can't go to U-Haul or even to a storage unit without them trying to sell you boxes.
Actually, you know what? Going and moving, you go to the grocery store out in the back, get their boxes.
Oh, absolutely. And so you think about a sustainable fuel source, cardboard boxes, those corrugated boxes, are one of the best around. And even like if you have, because we'll store stuff in plastic as well. So, you know, you've got those clip-on lids.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
Well, what is plastic made out of? It's a petroleum-based product. So once those things ignite and it begins to change, that kind of a chemical change begins as you introduce heat to the substance that makes up those little – it becomes a sustainable fuel source after a while. You just have to attain enough heat in order to facilitate that.
But what about a rental unit that has limited oxygen? There's not a lot of wind blowing through. They're pretty, you know, they're tight. They've got doors on them, in this case, padlock door. But there's oftentimes not very much space inside those things.
Yeah, and you begin to think about, and this is something that many people don't think about. Let's see, how can I put this? Let's just say that you and I sit down, we go and we get inside of a two-man submarine, okay?
Okay.
In that submarine, as you
let me out. I'm already stuck. I can't handle it.
I couldn't take it. Well, you and I would be displacing the oxygen in there.
Right.
So for us introducing the mass of our bodies into that environment, then we're displacing that oxygen that would otherwise be there. So if you've got all of these items and you don't have free flowing air through there, you're going to have a limited amount of oxygen contained in that space. And so you begin to think about, well, if there's a victim in here, were they breathing at the time the fire initiated? Or is this something where perhaps they had died prior to, and someone decided to foolishly try to incinerate the body in there? That's why, you know, like one of the things you look at with this, you're thinking, geez, Louise, would somebody use a storage unit in order to render down a body? I don't, with fire, I don't know. It seems like it'd be rather glaring to me if you were like the watchman out there, you know, keeping tabs on the thing.
All right. Well, from a timeline standpoint, we know that Morgan Wingeyer was at the storage unit with her mother. They're seen on surveillance video at 12:36 p.m. We're talking November 7th now. November 7th in Michigan, in this particular area of Michigan. Is it going to be really cold?
Yes.
Okay.
At night in particular, and we're talking about night here.
Well, actually,
I mean, and keep in mind, we're Alabama boys too.
Right.
So their perception of cold might not be the same as ours, but when it gets down to it, if the environmental temperature is uncomfortable, you're going to be uncomfortable and it's going to be cold and you're going to look for a heat source, I would
think. Right. Now, Morgan Wingire's mother actually rented the storage unit for her, for Morgan. Morgan and her mother are seen at the storage unit at 12:36 p.m., so just afternoon. They then, on surveillance video, you can see Morgan Wingire actually put a padlock on the door and lock it. They then leave. Mm. At 8:30 that night, on surveillance video, smoke is seen coming out from the storage unit. I don't know to what level because it's dark, but enough that it can be seen on surveillance video. Just after 9 p.m., flames are seen coming out of the storage units. And these are several units sitting side by side. At just around 11 p.m., police and fire show up to the fire, which has now been going on for at least an hour and a half, 2 hours, at least 2.5 hours because of when the smoke was first seen.
Yeah, and the firefighters are merely being called out to a structure fire.
Yeah,
they have no idea.
Got a storage unit on fire. That's all
we
got.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
But the thing is that they didn't know until they opened the door. And I wonder how this goes on, Joe, because they get there and they see the storage units. They're not all padlocked from the outside. Now, I'm going to guess that you and I both have rented storage units, and yeah, if you put your stuff in there, you do put a lock on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you definitely do. And there are some that have the – I've seen some that have, like, it's not really a deadbolt, but there's, like, an external lock that comes – the thing comes equipped with.
Right.
Which I would never trust in a million years. If I've got valuables in there, I'm going to buy the top-of-the-line lock and put it – which can still be defeated pretty easily with a pair of bolt cutters, which it appears is what – the fire service used to gain access. They had
a simple padlock was used on the door.
Yeah, they had to get in there and they had to cut that lock in order to gain access to it.
Now, when they opened this door, Joe, because their other units were on fire, I'm going to assume it's not just one little place.
Right.
We know it's been burning for 2.5 hours based on surveillance video, at least 2.5 hours.
Yep.
But we don't know the actual starting point yet. We don't know, did it start in the padlocked room or did it start in one of the other units? The only thing we do know is that at 12:36 p.m., Morgan Wingire and her mother were outside that unit number 454 when Morgan actually put a padlock on the door and spun it to lock the door. Firemen show up, they cut the padlock off and get in the door. And what do they find, Joseph Scott Morgan?
Well, they find a young woman's body that is in amongst the burned debris in this environment. And she's deceased, you know, at this point in time. There's no saving her or anything like this. And immediately, you know, I think that, first off, anytime there's a structure fire, you're going to have a fire marshal that's going to come out. And probably a fire investigator, and they're going to say,
"Now, wait a minute, I didn't know that. Wait, anytime there's a building, a structure that is on fire, they actually begin an investigation. Is that because of arson?"
I mean, and nothing's, you know, look, the firefighters, and God bless them, they've saved my life before. I love firefighters. I love working with them, and I've said that plainly many times over the years. They're not there to assess a scene other than trying to get a fire knocked down and make it safe. And once they back out, as it said, once all the flames have been knocked down and they've got the thing secured, that's when searches begin. Now, firefighters do find bodies, okay? Mm-hmm. So if they're in there and they're walking around, they've got the big, powerful lights on, they've got respirators on, you know, so because can you imagine the amount of smoke inside this thing? And it would have just come rolling out on them. I'm amazed by the fact that they were able to appreciate her body in that environment. But once you find that body like that, particularly in this case, and they have subdued the fire to the point they've knocked it down, there's no more flame, they're going to back out and they're going to secure this thing and they're going to call an arson investigator. They're going to call the police. And in this case, what they found was unimaginable. I think it's kind of obvious, Dave. You can't lock yourself into a structure with a padlock. They've already got CCTV of this young woman locking the door. What fascinates me about this is that Wingmeyer's mother was physically there. How do you not have an awareness that there's somebody in there? You know what I'm saying? That's kind of...
Isn't that odd that the story that we've been told is that Morgan Wingmeyer, her mother rented the storage unit for her, and she was allowing Corinne Obasamra to stay in the unit. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say this is not an apartment. This is a storage unit. And Morgan Wingmeyer and Corinne Obasamra, according to Morgan's mother, had been in a relationship previously.
Yeah.
And this is all coming from Morgan's mother. Morgan Wingmeyer has not spoken out about this. We have no quotes from her. She's in jail right now. We'll tell you why.
Yeah.
But it's her mother that gives us the quotes, Joe, about them being in a relationship. And that she claimed that Corinne Obasamra had been homeless, a homeless person. I'm going to be straight up with you, man. Corinne Obasamra, highly educated woman.
Very much so.
At 33 years old, she's got her degrees. She's got her career. She's going places.
Yeah.
So I'm going to follow down a path here, and I'm going to suggest something that is unpopular, but Morgan Wingmeyer had been arrested last year, 2023, on methamphetamine charges, okay? Based on the situation, Morgan Wingmeyer is hiding Corinne Obasamra in that storage unit from her mother, from Morgan's mother.
Wow. And I don't know. I mean, this is all speculative on
yes.
my part. You know, so what would be the motivation behind a grown woman hiding another grown woman
in a storage unit?
In a storage unit, unless you were trying to, I don't know, perhaps, you know, knock down any kind of suspicion on the mother's part that they were still involved in a relationship.
Right. The padlock came from, they're at the survey, at the unit, and the mother says, you know, because it's rented in the mother's name. And her mother insists, you're not going to put a lock on that? Put a lock on that storage unit. That's when Morgan put the lock on the storage unit. That's when she locked that padlock on at 12:36 p.m. It was because her mother rented the unit. Her mother said, put a lock on that.
Yeah, and we're talking, dude, we're talking hours afterwards.
Oh, buddy, you know, think about it, Joe. The 12:36, they're at the unit. The smoke is seen at 8:30 on surveillance. At 9, flames are seen. At 11, cops and fire show up. But Morgan Wingmeyer never shows back up. Police go looking for her and don't find her until the next day at 11:30 a.m. in a hotel. She said she had no plans to be away from the unit that long. She just got tied up with doing some errands. Well, at 23 hours, she left that woman in that padlocked storage unit, Joe, for 23 hours without anything. And by the way, she wasn't headed back over to the unit when police found her. Police found her in a hotel room.
What would be the motivation for you to take up at least temporary residency in a motel somewhere? So to the point where you're adjunct to a fire, that you were last known, your last known whereabouts was going to be at that fire, locking the door. And all of a sudden you come up registered at a motel. And look, I mean, why are you not going back to your mother's house? Why are you? And so many questions come about here. And I begin to think, was this purposed? You know, what were you just being mean? I hate to reduce it down to that,
wow. But
were you just because, you know, I will go ahead and give this bit away. She has been charged, Dave, with false imprisonment.
Right.
Now, if you say false imprisonment, you know, maybe angels dancing on the head of the pin here, but you begin to think, well, gee whiz, was she actually imprisoning her to hold her, or did she just create the environment where it's legitimate? She forgot that she was in there. How do you forget another human being that you, according to the mother, that you have been involved in an intimate relationship with? How do you forget that person that you had locked them in there? I don't understand it.
Well, you know what? Sometimes, and I'm just going to speculate that sometimes people who use drugs lose track of time, especially when they use drugs like methamphetamine. They tend to lose track of time. I'm not suggesting for a minute that Morgan Wingire went out on a drug binge and ended up in a hotel when police found her to tell her that her storage unit was burned up with a person inside, and they have her on surveillance video padlocking the door. By the way, Corinne Obasamra was left inside that storage unit, Joe, with nothing.
Nothing.
No food, no water, no light, and no phone. No means of communication to call for help or anything else.
Yeah, who in the world nowadays, I know there are people, don't get me wrong, but who doesn't have at least a burner phone, you know, with them? And we're talking about a lady that is, by all accounts, is highly educated, has been successful. You listen to her family talk about her, and she's been involved in things like public service, you know, like working with people, outreach, those sorts of things. She's got this kind of bubbly personality. And you think about, well, what, you know, what kind of detour did she take in her life that would wind up with her inside of a non-heated, non-electrified storage unit where she doesn't have access to heat? She's just kind of cast aside in the thing and then locked down. And then suddenly, mysteriously, a fire begins. You know, David, fire is such a mystery. We've covered on Body Bags, we've covered some fire cases in the past. But you know, fire is such a mystery. The most important thing, I think, for fire investigators and death investigators is to try to determine two things. First off, the source of the heat. Remember, I talked about the uninhibited chemical chain reaction of a fire. Is it sustainable? And adjacent to that is going to be point of origin. Where did this thing start? Because you have to wonder, did it start in the middle of the floor? I don't know about you, but Dave, correct me if I'm wrong. Storage units are commonly built on concrete slabs, aren't they?
The it's ones like I've rented have been, yes.
And yeah, this one, and video, bolted to the ground. The support beams and everything are, you know, those girders are like, you know, they're driven into the ground with bolts and held in place. It's not like you're going to dig a fire pit, you know, and create a fire. And even if you did, what are you going to use as fuel in there?
And, you know, I think that's why there is some mystery surrounding this, because so far we haven't been told that the fire began in that unit. We were only told that fire department officials had to cut the padlock off of it to get inside. And, you know, we can assume that that's where the fire began. We can assume because they were knocking it down everywhere else, but they still had a problem in that unit. We can assume those things, but we don't know that for fact. No. That's why I was asking you about oxygen in a room and how much there, because you're in a confined area that's usually a box, you know, it's 12 by 14 or whatever, and it usually has stuff in it. You know, let's just say for the sake of all that's good and human in this world, that here this poor woman is in being hidden in a storage unit with nothing. And maybe she's got a lighter in her pocket, and maybe she's trying to light. She's cold. She's hungry. She's thirsty. Maybe she's trying to just burn, you know, something to stay warm, trying to burn some papers or clothes. I don't know. But at what point do we look at this and say she was in there for at least 10 hours before the fire was seen? You know,
what a hopeless feeling that would be.
You know,
no matter how much you rattle or bang on that door, nobody's coming to your rescue. The thing is locked externally, and there's not a latch. I don't think, I'm sure that people out there will correct me, but to the best of my knowledge, it's not an internal latch. And even if there was, it's secured from the outside. So how hopeless would that be? And listen, this is the other thing too. We're talking about November. So in the middle of the day, this metallic box that you've got all your stuff stored in, you're going to have some radiant heating that's in there. But brother, as that sun begins to dip down up there in Michigan, you're going to feel that chill. And can you imagine, let's just say for the sake of argument that she is in fact seated on that concrete floor, how cold that is. And it's one of those, if you've ever sat on like really cold stone like that for a protracted period of time, you know how people say, I can feel the cold in my bones. That's the way it feels. It just kind of travels up throughout your body. And, you know, for, I don't know what she had that she could have wrapped herself in. You know, did she have a blanket even? You know, one of the basic necessities of life, warmth, heat, protection, coverage. Were there any other clothes that were in there that she could have put on just to, you know, try to salvage any kind of heat that her little body was generating in that environment? But we do have a clue here, Dave. There was a comment that firefighters made in regards to this, and I found this kind of compelling, Dave. They didn't say that her body was found. They said that her charred remains were found. And that's different, because I've worked a lot of cases over the years where people did, in fact, die of smoke inhalation. You know, the old adage about how many times have we seen the thing? We even learned it when we were kids. If there's a fire in the room, you get on the floor and you crawl, right? You crawl because there's still breathable. Yeah. There's still breathable oxygen down there, but you do that in order to escape. Where are you going to escape to? Can you imagine the panic that would set in? Let's just say that she did in fact start a fire in there just for her own comfort. Well, where are you going to go to escape it? And the place is not lighted. She can't see what's around there. There may have been a lot of flammable items that were in there. But we do know that she's sequestered in this area against her will because she can't leave. I can't imagine anybody in their right mind saying, will you please get the padlock and lock me up inside of the storage unit and don't come back and check on me? And by the way, don't give me any means to communicate with anybody out there. It's mind-boggling when you think about it, Dave.
I actually went back over this story multiple times and looked through multiple sources, and because I kept thinking I'm missing something here. I am missing something. And in reality, if you make a couple of assumptions and you can get there, it's explainable as to what happened. Now, on its surface, just looking at it as just two Joe Blows, you have a person who, my mom rented this unit for me. And I'm hiding a friend in there, but I don't want my mom to find out. And I don't know how mom doesn't know, but she apparently doesn't know that Corinne Obasamra is staying inside the storage unit. And as they're getting ready to pull away that day, Morgan Wingire's mother says, hey, why is that not locked? Lock that up. That's my stuff and lock it up. So she does. Now, her intention, I'm going to come back in a couple hours. I'm going to lock it now, but I'm coming back. She knows. She, according to Morgan Wingire herself, she told police she knew that Corinne Obasamra had no phone, no food, no nothing. She knew that when she left her there. She didn't plan on leaving her there for a long time. She planned on coming back. But you know what? She didn't come back. And she didn't come back because I think she was probably, the only thing that explains it, Joe, is she was using drugs and was not coming back because of that, because she was high. Now,
she was cruel beyond measure.
If she did this intentionally and willfully, she locked somebody in there and then just didn't come back. Because I got to say this, it's not like this woman was only locked in there for 10 hours. Back up and regroup and realize the person that should put the padlock on there wasn't back there for 23 hours. Okay.
Yeah.
She didn't, it wasn't 10 hours in her mind's eye. It had been 23 hours when police found her at the hotel, and she still wasn't on her way back to the storage unit. So if that was her intent, to lock that girl up and let her die, mission accomplished.
Well, I think that we have some clues here, considering how she was charged, because they did, in fact, charge her, I believe, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, with involuntary manslaughter.
They did.
For right now. Because they haven't released a lot of information in regards to the status of this poor woman's body. And here's another bit. They don't know what the origin of this fire was.
I was hoping you did. I'm not in my notes. Ask Joe about the origin of the fire, because I can't find it anywhere and they're not saying.
Well, the origin most of the time is going to be determined. You've got two ways to frame origin. For most laymen, you'll say the origin is whatever started the fire. Okay, how did it originate? But for us, origin in forensics is more of a spatial assessment. Okay, like origin is where, you know, like your country of origin, your place of origin. So where did it start? How do we determine that? Most of the time, you're going to determine that based upon the degree of damage in a location. So it's relatively simple. The more damage you have in a location, that means that the fire is burned there the longest and perhaps more intensely. Like if you start a fire, if you've got a 16 by 20 room, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but anyway,
yeah.
You start a fire over in the corner of a room with drywall, you know, gypsum, mm-hmm. you know, made out of that. Maybe you stack some rags there, you put a little gasoline on it, you start it. Well, I'm not saying that that fire can't leap and get in behind the walls, because they do, get up in the ceiling, burn their way around. But the most damage that's going to be done is where those rags were. Well, here's the rub, if you will. If this is on a concrete surface and she started in the middle of the room, are they going to be able to tell what the actual point of origin was? Was it over in a corner? Because concrete doesn't necessarily, it'll be, you know, kind of scorched, scored, if you will. But it's not like wood that's going to, you know, become brittle and fall apart. Well, if it's right there on the floor, this could make this a bit more of a heavy lift for the forensics people after they get in there. Other thing I want to know, well, I guess the big ask is, how did the mother not know that there was a living human being inside of there? And that goes to the next question. Was she in fact living? Okay. So at autopsy, one of the things, the first things you're going to look for is going to be smoke inhalation. Did she inhalate or breathe in, inhale the debris that's burning up around her, or is there no evidence of that, where you don't have any of the soot, as we refer to it, into the airway, into the lungs, into the nares, the nose, the sinuses? Is it absent any kind of damage? You can actually, you know, when you do a dissection on a throat, on the neck, the elements of the neck, and you look into the trachea. This is one of the most horrible things to me, by the way, Dave. Did you know that when we open the neck, we'll cut right down through the center of it, through the airway. And if an individual has been exposed to superheated air, there are focal areas inside of the airway where it was burning. Just grab hold of that just for a second. You can see color changes that are like, oh my God, this person. And if you've ever been around a fire, like an outdoor fire perhaps, and a bonfire, and you're too close to it, it's one thing, you feel the heat coming off. But if you take a breath in, you can feel the heat that you're taking on board. Just imagine, you can't escape from the bonfire. There's nowhere to run. You're right there. Everything is burning up around you. So my big question from a forensics perspective is, was she alive at the time that the fire was going on? Because it begs this question, how could the mother not have an awareness that this person was in there? Were they just quiet? Had something else happened to them beforehand? And secondly, I want to know what exactly was her cause of death. If it's not smoke inhalation, were there other injuries sustained? And that opens up an entire myriad of problems that you're faced with fires, because if you're talking about a bullet hole, somebody's been shot, you can still pick up on that with x-rays. You can actually see, I've seen bodies that have been burned after they were executed, execution style, in the back of the head, and you can still see within the cranial vault, if you will, you'll see this kind of lead snowstorm that's in there where the projectile particulated and kind of spread out through there. You can still see that. Some fires get so hot, though. I've had cases where fires have gotten so hot. First off, you have heat fractures to bone as well as the skull. I've opened up skulls before where brains were liquefied because of the heat. It's almost like the brain boiled inside of the skull. So those types of things do happen. It's hard to take the measure of it, isn't it? So there's a lot more unanswered questions that need to be asked. I think that it's possible that if they see anything that is other than as advertised, as I say many times, they can upcharge her more than likely, Dave, on this. It wouldn't just simply be involuntary manslaughter. If they find something else is going on with her, then they can certainly, I think, you know, probably make those charges a bit more robust. Do you think that?
Yeah, you've opened my eyes to a lot of the things that I didn't realize were possible in figuring out. So I went back to make sure that it wasn't smoke inhalation, that, you know, what did they find? What did fire and police find? And they found the charred remains of Corinne Albasamra. And that's what we know.
Yeah.
And then we know that Morgan Wingire put the padlock on the door at 12:36 p.m., and was gone. They didn't even find her for 23 hours. And when they did, she was at a hotel. She was not at the unit. The unit right. burned that day. So I'm looking at it from the person who put the lock on. She didn't come back. She yeah. said she planned to come back, but she didn't. So what was it? Did you really want to just, were you killing this person by putting, and then you mentioned it. Was she killed before this happened and a fire started in another unit and yeah. came into that unit? That's a possibility, right?
Yeah, it is. Wow. You brought back a memory when you said, was there an intent to kill her? And that would make this almost like almost a passive form of homicide. Wow. Instead of kind of a proactive, like I'm going to, not I,
yeah,
but I'm going to take a weapon and do away with somebody. It's almost like passively, you know, well, you know, and that goes to this idea of neglect, which we see, you know, that comes up in other cases, but this is on a different level because whether you're drug addled or not, I don't know what her status is, but you're subjecting this woman first off to just sheer panic.
Right.
Cause I don't know about you. I don't do good in small, dark spaces. I'm not saying the storage unit is small by any means. However, can you imagine bumping around in the dark and you don't have any source of light? You have no idea what's in there. I mean, boxes and just debris.
Even worse, Joe, yeah. if it was nothing. If there was nothing in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
All you're doing is walking around a cell that you can't see.
Yeah, I know. And there's no source of light. Every storage unit I've had has had, I think, some light switch in it. Now, I've had one that didn't. And I've had them that don't have power sources either, or I guess for good reason, you know, where you can't plug in something in there. I've had other ones, and you get what you get, you know, if you
right.
upcharge, you know, they'll upcharge you for it. You know, and certainly, you know, you have the ones that are in climate, you know, they always use the term climate-controlled storage units, you know.
I got mine one set up from the dirt barn in my neighbor's backyard, you know, cheapest one I could find. That's where my stuff was packed.
Yeah, exactly. And so you consider all of that. If I think the big thing here is, was there intent to do harm to this poor woman? And we can't say at this point in time if her intention was just to leave her in there forever and ever. Amen. We don't know, but we do know that this poor woman was locked in a storage unit and abandoned for hours upon hours until mysteriously a fire starts. There's going to be more to follow in this case, but till then, I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.